Inside the Game, brought to you by Raider Media.
It's been a turbulent time on the sporting front, and all fronts for that matter, with pretty much no sport taking place throughout the world. It's yet another crisis that Cricket South Africa acting chief executive Jacques Fall has had to deal with in his short stint back at the top of the organisation. Welcome to Inside the Game, brought to you by Raider Media. In this edition, I'm chatting to that man in the hottest of hot seats, Jacques Fall. Jacques, welcome back to the show. And firstly, happy Freedom Day.
Yeah, thank you. Happy Freedom Day to you and all the listeners as well. It's quite a ironic festive day for all of us. But we've got to stay positive, and I'm sure this too shall pass.
Yeah, certainly so. The irony is not lost on me. Of course, back in 1994, South Africa celebrated its first democratic election. But right now, we are experiencing anything but freedom. And of course, I'm not referencing South Africa, but the world over, as we sit during lockdown, pretty much outside has been is illegal, so to speak. And that's, of course, affecting the cricketing front as well. And Jacques, I mean, it's your second time in the hot seat. You took over in 2012, your first stint as chief executive. This time around, one could argue, which has been the toughest job that you've had playing both roles, 2012 and now in 2019? And I can imagine with COVID-19 coming to the fore, it's been anything but easy.
I think there were different challenges in 2012, although I think the reputational challenge is probably the same the second time around. But now the COVID-19 crisis has changed the scenario for us significantly, Derek. So, yeah, it's much more challenging this time around. It's almost crisis on crisis. So I think we were a little bit protected in that we went into the off-season. CSA were, to be fair, vulnerable even before the COVID-19 crisis. And I thought that we were made a lot of good progress in terms of recovery, and we had at least a clear plan on what we're trying to do. But the world's definitely in crisis, developed very quickly. The impact's massive. Like I said, we probably a little bit protected going into the off season, but we're not an island. Our sponsors will be severely affected by this, and also our ability to sign up new sponsors. And then, of course, everything is driven on live content. So if the lockdown and the restrictions remain into August this year, then we've got serious challenges.
Yeah, you alluded to it, the fact that you were of the better placed organisations, and that, yeah, domestically the season was pretty much wrapped up. We did lose a few games, though. And in terms of finances, we all know the problems that CSA were facing over the last year. And, I mean, this, yeah, you say if this had to go beyond August, it would cause serious concerns. I mean, you coming into the role as it was, I mean, there were really serious concerns regarding the money situation with CSA.
Yeah, it's been a concern. I mean, the projected deficit is basically the problem. And, the situation's been magnified now, potentially being magnified now as well. But I think we did well to get additional content to sell to the broadcasters. There were a lot of cost cutting that we have done, and a lot of savings. We remain vulnerable because you're still bound by your fixed contracts and your fixed costs. It's been challenging getting out of that, and now I have to deal with a low level of predictability when it comes to the crisis. And we've done some scenario planning, and we continue to do so. And I guess you've got to be positive. What we have done is we've divided our strategy into offensive and a defensive strategy, a dual approach in defensive one will focus on cost cutting and savings, where the defensive one and the offensive one will focus on, you know, money generation and income generation, because that's important. It's also important to have almost a dual mindset. If we just try and save, we will not survive the crisis. We probably just delay the major effects of it, whereby if we start in an offensive mindset as well, to see how can we monetize, how can we do it a bit differently. I'm comfortable with the strategies that we had. And so Cricket South Africa went on a 6-5-4 strategy, which was just a cost-cutting exercise. When COVID-19 came in, we had a specific strategy with the steering committee. But we're also going to look at future cricket. So how do we make sure that cricket's still sustainable? And we're trying to work off one document here. So we had a four-pillar strategy. The first one to deal with the crisis was just safety. The second one is using our voice. The third one is to engage with our stakeholders. And then the fourth one is the offensive strategy, where we plan to see where we can generate income to mitigate the effect the best. But to be fair, I'm a chief executive in cricket now for 17 years, and I don't think anybody has experienced anything like this. We sent our strategy to the ICC and all the member full member CECs at a telecom the other day, and you know, with such a low level of predictability and our industry depending on live sport. It's been really, really challenging, I must be honest. But I think it's important that we show leadership, we remain positive, and, we plan as best as we can.
Jacques, I've known you for many years, and we've worked a lot together during your time at the Titans. And I was always amazed in terms of trailblazers. The Titans were head and shoulders above the other unions. And you had massive plans and ideas for the Titans. And, of course, you've since moved from that role. You're acting chief executive of CSA. You speak about content generating and new plans to develop, given the impact of COVID-19. Can you divulge some of them? I mean, as you mentioned, you're in the business of live sport. That is your bread and butter. If there is no live sport, that takes a massive chunk of the pie out. So how do you work your way around it?
Yeah, I think the key is in what you just said, is you've got to work your way around the restrictions. So the first question would be, how do we play in a lockdown situation or without crowds? Now, that is possible, and we're actually working on certain possibilities. And with a crisis like this, the world actually moves. There's new technology that comes in. So we are looking at a very innovative concept as we speak. I've got to give Graham Smith a lot of credit. He's quite entrepreneurial of nature. He's taken this task like you would hope a leader would. But he's quite, like I said, quite innovative as well. So we got to look at how do we get live sport back. So the feel of live sport, of course, it's unscripted entertainment, and that's what you got to get back as soon as possible. And you know, work your way around it. The reasons for restricting it is straightforward. It could be almost a time bomb. Can imagine having 30,000 people in and how many contact points they represent after leaving a stadium. So one do understand that it's not possible, but maybe it's good that we look at it. Unfortunately, the financial models all over the world differs a little bit. Ours are mainly via Lens international broadcast, mainly the Indian content, very important for us. Hence, we've got to also see where we, why are we so dependable? Usually models change after a big crisis like this. So that will be, an interesting space to look into it. I also foresee a congested future tour program. We've already postponed one outgoing tour to Sri Lanka. West Indies still under consideration, but that could be suspended or postponed as well. So how would one deal? There's the T20 World Cup in October. But what we did at the Titans, I think the Titans were in a position where they could be innovative. They had the luxury of trying new things, globalizing, looking differently at things. You almost got to get into that position now. I think some of it's born out of need, and that's where we now with Cricket South Africa, other than where I felt that the Titans had good reserves, they were a well-oiled machine, they had good support, and hence they almost try to stay on top and come up with new innovative things whereby Cricket South Africa now, we need to do this to survive. We need to be a bit more innovative. Got to come up with a game changer. But it does also make you sleep a bit less, Derek, because there's some big challenges. But yeah, like I said, I'm comfortable with the way we've reacted in terms of we were, even before lockdown, we terminated our operations. We had a clear idea in terms of the four pillar strategy, what should be done. We recalled the Proteas. I thought Graham dealt with the the winners of the competitions very well. We've made some appointments. There's some hard decisions that needs to be made in terms of funding, and I'm sure we will also do that in a very responsible way.
Yeah, I think with the announcements of the various competition winners, there weren't really many arguments in that respect. I think you'll have a very different story were the Premier League over in England to announce their various winners over the next couple of months if there were to be no football to take place. Now, you mentioned Graham a couple of times. Now, he was recently appointed into the role in a full-time capacity as director of cricket. Was it challenging to get him to sign on the dotted line given what has now taken place with regards to COVID-19?
I think his concerns were more related to the governance at Cricket South Africa that made him feel uncomfortable and the uncertainty around it, which I think he publicly did mention. But yeah, he's a team player. Once we got him in and we got him working, he's a natural leader, he's a highly intelligent individual. And I've been, I wouldn't say surprised about his performance levels because, he was such a successful captain, but how he adopted to his role as administrator has been amazing. He's a natural leader, but he's been a pillar of strength for us, Derek. I'm very impressed with him. I probably can't say it enough. And his work ethic's good, works hard, smart, innovative. He's quite a, people would look at him as a hard man, but let me tell you, he gets the buy-in from a lot of people. People like working with him. He's got good support. Let me tell you now, Edward Koza, the acting head of Pathways, very good. Corrie van Zyl, since he's come back, has been incredible. A lot of experience. Administratively, he's very strong. So you need that. You need people to feed off each other and complement each other. So in this testing times, hopefully, that will get us in. Graham will be one of the leaders of that offensive strategy. He's in administration terms. I think he's batting with both his hands broken now. So we need him to guts it out there. I think we need to score about 438 and not even 434. So it's some challenging times, but I think he's added a lot of value. He's also credible. He's respected in South Africa. He's got a good network of the captains of industry. Very useful people. He's almost our version of François Pinault now. So I'm very impressed with him.
Of course, in the midst of COVID-19, when it first started to affect the world, the Proteas were recalled from their very short ODI tour of India without a match having taken place. The first one was rained out, and the recent tour to Sri Lanka has been called off. But news emanating that you have secured an incoming India tour in August.
Well, that was on the cards. And again, Graham's got to take a lot of credit for it. Indian content is your most valuable properties. That content is worth a lot of American dollars. And again, we hope that we will be able to host it. India remains a very important business partner for us. But again, you know, you can use Graham's friendship, if you like, with somebody like a Sourav Ganguly. It makes it easier, to get negotiations going. And we literally flew over for a day, you know, Graham, after he understood the value of the property, you know, set up the meeting. He, you know, was very instrumental in negotiating it. So it's one thing understanding the impact of these things, the other thing to get a deal going. So we hope that that's still on the cards. It is very important for us.
So Graham recently losing his title as acting director of cricket. When is Jacques Fall going to lose his title of acting in the chief executive part of Cricket SA?
Yeah, to be fair, we got to deal with the suspended CEO first, so we cannot make any announcements for that. And that's also procedurally correct. They got to deal with him. He's at this stage, there's suspended CEO, so his matters got to be dealt with. I don't work with it directly, understandably. So it's, I guess, the COVID-19 crisis and lockdown didn't help that as well. But, you know, that's got to be dealt with. And then, you know, I think they, if they deal with it in a way that allows for a new person to come in, and that's of course, not a given, but then, you know, I will probably have a look and consider it or not. But I talk to the wife first. but for me now, you know, Derek, luckily I've been here before and I did it for a year. So I know how to plan this time around a little bit better. You know, put some nice short-term and medium-term strategies in place. So, you know, it doesn't matter who takes over, who comes back. You know, people can just go on with it. Like I said, probably more experience second time around in the acting capacity, and you know, continuation is important. You know, the company is not built on one person, and hopefully we will get through this as well.
Yeah, you came in a time of crisis, and you mentioned that Graham was hesitant to get on board on a full-time basis because of the governance in CSA. That, of course, has changed. Legally, I don't know how much you can divulge, but, I mean, you were brought in once again on a rescue mission. You did the job back in 2012. We had the Gerald Majola episode. This time around, your predecessor, Thabang Maroe, taking over from him. With the organization in deep, deep trouble. Of course, you had a board that also put him in place, a lot of which are still present. I keep on using the word challenging. I mean, what is the current situation there? I mean, you talk about an organization, or you talk about saving money, where we've got a suspended prior chief executive who's still on the payroll. That can't help matters, I'm sure.
Oh, so that is the challenge. It becomes an expensive exercise with the suspended chief executive. Look, the board, we've got a governance dashboard. We're in the process, hopefully, of appointing new independent directors that will help. I think a lead independent director will also be appointed. A lot of the, you know, calling by sponsors have been dealt with, their concerns. And you almost, the current board, some of them comes to an end in August. So you're approaching that as well, you know, Derek. So the board in itself will significantly change. If you've got three new independents, you'll have a new president, vice president after the election. So the board is then in itself significantly changed. You know, a matter of accountability, you know, the board's got to deal with that perception as well. It is challenging. It might also be a good time to actually look at the composition of boards. Should they not be a bit more independent? But, you know, like in 2012-13, we've got work to do on that level as well. We've got to show progress. We've got to improve the situation, and just shows you how effective a negative perception can be. We've done well to reach out to Saka, and I've got to compliment them for their willingness to also work with us and work with the players. I think we've reached out nice to some of the broadcasters. And so we've ticked a few boxes. I'm comfortable with that. But in saying there's surely there's some challenges left in terms of governance.
Yeah, you speak about the board makeup. I think, if I'm not mistaken, currently we sit with two independents, in Mario Schumann and Steve Cornelius, majority non-independents. I think Sascock does favour the non-independent method, so we would probably stick around to that for now. But yeah, and again, you've got people who selected someone who is currently suspended, who were in charge of that role, who were putting him in that place, and who led them down this path of almost destruction, which you've had to come in, and along with various others, had to try and clean up. It's an incredibly messy position to be in. And can you see the wood for the trees? I mean, is there light at the end of the tunnel, and is it fast approaching?
Not sure it's fast approaching, but it, you know, it's definitely improving. Like I said, the board composition will, the members sitting on the board will look different in August already. So, you know, it is what it is. What is a bit complex with our situation is you've got a members council, so that's all 14 your president. So if somebody resigns, you know, on the board and he's a president, he still remains on the members council, which is actually the highest authority. If you want to change anything big in cricket, it's got to go to the members council. So the unintended consequences of this is that even if you resign as a board member, you're still part of the forum that influences policy and decision making, and that's what needs to be addressed. So your independence, you know, they've got no vested interest. And I must be honest, both Mario Schumann and Prof. Cornelissen has done an amazing job. And that was the difference that came in 2012-13. Nicholson actually preferred a majority independent board. And you're right in saying that Sascock says, no, it's got to be the other way around. And, you know, that's open for a debate. I think we can actually learn, Derek, is we see independent as somebody that's never played cricket, you know, that just has got an HR or a legal background or accounting background, whereby I'm going to use a good example, somebody like Errol Stewart, that's a lawyer, works for Standard Bank. You've got Andrew Hudson, it's another good example, actually, of somebody. And I think you can reach out to that as well, so that you still have cricket people in there. You know, especially I think back in the day, people still studied. You know, they weren't full-time professionals, if you like. So, you know, they pursued another career, and I think those are people that can be of great value for us. It's very difficult if there's a negative perception of the board, and I think this crisis has highlighted it. Also, in terms of accountability. You know, you operate in the public domain, so if you get it wrong, you know, they call for your head if you're the coach or the CEO or the board. And that's where we play. That's how we operate it. And you've got to take the rough with the smooth, you know, when it goes well and people support you and they support your team and your brand and they, you sell the association for millions of rands, then it works in your favor. But when you get it wrong, then, you know, the public is also going to come hard at you. The same with the media. The media reflects the public sentiment and is also a medium of communication. And there's no doubt we got it wrong in terms of revoking accreditations and the way, you know, CSA has operated in the past. There's no way that I can sit here today and justify it. I mean, that's impossible. And the board has got to convince Cricket South, not just the cricket fraternity, but also got to convince South Africa that they're on the right track and they're going to be given a chance.
Speak about the rough with the smooth. The certainly is the rougher part of the interview. I promise you we'll get to the smooth side of things shortly. But also, again, with the financials, forensic audit currently underway as we speak. How's that going?
I think I was also, you know, I must be honest, a great step in trying to get credibility going. So we called for the Independent. And they've scanned all the documents before lockdown, anticipated it quite well. So we got our first feedback. It's scheduled to end somewhere at the end of June. So that's still on the cards. And you know, the findings will be made public, which is a good thing to do. It's an independent organization that does the forensic investigation. And Derek, it's very important that we do this. This is the kind of steps that the board will have to do to get an independent body to say this is what went wrong and this is how we should act on it. So yeah, it's on track for now. It's never a nice thing to have a forensic investigation. Actually goes back 4 years, so it covers a lot of transactions over a long period of time. So yeah, findings I'm sure should be entertaining and interesting for everybody.
You spoke about SACA, and I mean, that was one of the main problems with regards to CSA and its relationships. I mean, at a point, it was pretty much non-existent, the relationship between SACA and CSA. You've had to mend those bridges considerably, and you've got the new man in charge in Andrew Bretzka taking over from the very well-respected Tony Irish, who's since moved to England. One of the major concerns of SACA, and this led to a massive initial court case, was the scrapping of the 16 franchise, which thankfully has since been scuffed in February.
Yeah, I think we... The board and the members' council admitted that maybe there was a concern that we didn't consult as indicated in the recognition agreement. So they rescinded the decision, which then, of course, took the legal matter off the table and we could engage with SACA. SACA has done really well over 17 years. Funny enough, Tony Irish and I almost started at the same time in 2003. And he is highly respected, and the duty of care for players has been amazing. We somehow, you know, just started to live further and further apart from SACA, which was unfortunate. I do think sometimes these are driven by, sadly, individual personalities. But, you know, we're definitely back on track. They serve on all our committees, from the COVID-19 to FinCom to CricketCom, back at the CEC. Andrew Bretzka is a very experienced man. He's a clear thinker. He thinks well strategically. And, you know, they're the main asset is players. You know, without players, you know, we won't be able to operate. It's going to take a while for the parties to trust each other fully. But, you know, we started with engaging. They'll be engaging about the new domestic structure. So, yeah, there's we had to reach out, but, you know, we still got to build trust. I personally get on well with both Tony Irish and Andrew Bretzka, which I think helps. Of course, Graham was ex-captain, so we worked closely with SACA in the past. So, you know, there's at least good, I would say, individual relationships going at this stage. They do add a lot of value, Derek. The amazing organization, and have you seen how they've grown and how they've built their internal capacity over the years? One got to compliment their efforts. I think they do put players first. They communicate well with players. And they fight for their players, and that's what you expect. If you and me belongs to a trade union, that's the kind of characteristics that you would want to see in a trade union. But yeah, happy to report that I think we, Andrew and I, would almost on a daily basis, you know, communicate, which is something we both agree that's important. Let's start talking about things.
Well, that, of course, was another massive fire that you had to put out since taking over the role. And I think legal costs were pretty substantial, but considering the alternative, you would have taken it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, the relationship was important for us going forward. You know, you don't want to distance yourself from players. I mean, I don't think that's the smartest thing to do. So, you know, legal costs, you're always going to incur some cost. I think in a way we probably also could save cost. There's always a risk. One never knows with these, civil matters. It's on a balance of probabilities. It can go anywhere. Our version of the recognition agreement might not be similar to that of a judge. It's definitely not similar to that of SACA. So there were risks involved in that as well, Derek.
In South Africa, we've got the Big Five. In the cricketing world, we've also got the Big Five in the form of Simon Harmer, Dwayne Willifier, Dan Vilas, Riley Rousseau, and Carl Abbott, five players that are Coldpack players plying their trades over in the UK. Now, with the recent fall of Brexit and the Coldpack situation very much up in the air, what's the situation with regards to them and their futures in SA cricket and possibly the Proteas?
We actually in conversation with Tom Harrison, the ECB CEO, on it, that's given us updates. So our understanding of it is that the Coldpack situation, which is based on European law, Coldpack is actually a handball player. And based on the treaties that were signed, it created a loophole that you can play or work, as a local citizen. So that's where Coldpack, now, of course, with the UK leaving the European Union, that has changed it. And so the law of the land will now come in play. And it seems to be a little bit uncertainty on the way that they are going to deal with it, or when will it be phased out. But I think it's fair to say at some stage you won't be able to play under the Coldpack ruling. Hence, you then play as an overseas player. That changes the status significantly for us, because Harmer, to use as an example, would play his trade in the county setup, and of course then play as a local player, whereby somebody like Dean Elgar would play as overseas players. Mm. Now, a county is allowed one overseas player as well. Now, of course, Elgar is available to play for us, and Harmer is not, because one of the Coldpack rules is that you then have to forfeit your right to play for your country. I guess it doesn't make sense to play as a local if you still play for another country. So it opens up the opportunity that all of these players at some stage, hopefully in the new year, will be available for us. I guess the big question would be, do you then select free agents, similar to somebody like Chris Morris that doesn't have a contract with a local franchise? So based on the fact that they're South African citizens, do you then select them? Now, Graham has again indicated that he wants the best team to play for South Africa. We're waiting to get finality on the ruling in terms of how the county is going to deal with it. It looks like they're going to have two international players per county. Now, that will be perfect for us. And then, I guess you've got to speak with these players on a one-to-one basis to hear if they still want to play. The five you mentioned is amazing. Harmer must be the best off-spinner in the world at this stage. So, you want people of his caliber to play. He's a fantastic player. Abbott, Riley, Vilas is an amazing player. So, hopefully, that's what the rugby did. If you remember Rassie's approach, is the one thing he probably changed up front is that you can select people that don't play for South African team. So, it is a decision that Graham and also the powers to be will have to make. But I got to be fair. I think it's important that in the modern era, you got to recognise that this is professional sport. If you want to draw on the best players to help you win, this is the way to go. Similar with soccer, you can imagine if the overseas teams wouldn't select from the Premier League because you don't play in a local league. And, it's how professional sports evolve. Rugby has done it, and that it could be something that we will definitely consider favourable. knowing sport, Derek, like you do, it's got to go through a few committees first to get the heads up. But, we, in terms of the frequency of dealing with it, we need clarity from the UK almost first, so that we hear what is the status, how are they going to deal with it. But it's a given that you won't be able to play in terms of the loophole created by the European law. That won't be possible.
And then there's the A.B. de Villiers factor, a man that you've known since his teenage days, was also a stalwart over at the Titans, possible coming out of international retirement to take part in the World T20, which may or may not happen. But on top of that, there's also the extended run with the Proteas, which I'm sure fans are hoping to see. But have you had many dealings with him, or perhaps know about Graham having had dealings with him?
Yeah, we've had initial discussions. AB is a wonderful man. There's so much misinformation around AB that it's sometimes unreal. He's just a wonderful human being, which I think just wants to play for South Africa, and he has done so over a long period of time. And I think AB will play till he's 70 if he has his own way. So again, we'd like to sit down once the World Cup's totally confirmed and talk to AB. Again, I think it's what Graham said. He wants his best team to play. And AB brings a lot. It's easy for him to be in a team. He's a team player. He's respected by teammates. So, it's absolute rubbish that he's selfish or having demands. Not at all. He's we want him to play. We want him involved, and we just got to find a way around it. I think there's still a bit of uncertainty with him. I felt that the whole saga around the 50 over World Cup was a disaster. I think we got to deal with it a bit better.
You spoke about Graham Smith earlier, about hesitant to come into the fray because of the governance. I can imagine that AB de Villiers sort of felt the same way. And you could probably put it down to the fact that your presence has motivated Graham to come in on a permanent basis and probably has pulled AB de Villiers towards the Proteas once again. Do you like to think yourself as the glue that's starting to mend the broken vase?
I think it's always a team effort. I think the fact that Boucher coaches the Proteas will play a role. He's also respected. He's very close to AB in his playing days. I think Graham and I, we've always had a good relationship, so I guess you trust people, but I also trust him. I'd like to think it's just there's more considerations just me than me, Derek. You need a team, to take it forward. The game is bigger than one person. I think we're temporary custodians of the game, and let's just leave the game, in a better place than we found it, or at least the same in our case. And do your bit. The game is bigger than all of us. I've been fortunate to have relationships with the likes of Graham. Remember, he was captain when I was around in 2012. So we've worked during that period as well with Gary. With AB, I've worked quite a lot, at Titans and also 2012. So I guess that helps a little bit if you've worked with somebody in the past. And I guess if you know somebody, you're more likely to trust them. I'm definitely no superhuman being, the world's best sports administrator. I more have a philosophy of being authentic and transparent as much as I can, and working hard and trying hard. And if that formula helps the organization, then I'm happy to contribute.
There's no question the majority of your work is done in the boardrooms and in your offices. And I've toured with you plenty with regards to the Titans. We've had trips over to Abu Dhabi, Namibia, to name a few. And I've always been impressed by how you've let the players, and in this instance it was Mark Boucher who was coaching the Titans at the time, just get on with it. You had very little, I don't want to say the word interference, but you didn't really bring in a hands-on approach as the administrative head of the team. Is that very much your way of thinking with the Proteas? Is it Graham and Mark's baby, the men's side, and to do it, and you'll deal with matters behind the scenes?
It never made sense for me to try and influence, almost cricketing legends, of the game. I think it was a success recipe at the Titans. It's definitely a deliberate approach. Like I said, I'd rather capacitate them, help them. They do come from time to time and seek a bit of advice and one offer it. It's definitely not be who bats three and who bats four. So your wisdom, would be on other areas of administration. But in 2012, same approach. I always try to stop interference with the team. It is a philosophy of mine, and I think it's worked quite nicely over the years. Rather protect them than try and influence it. We've done so well at the Titans that I hope the same will continue at the Proteas. You can imagine, how would I now influence anything tactically with somebody like a Mark Boucher, Enoch Nkwe, and Graham Smith on board? You want to leave that to them. If you want to manage the hospital, you don't have to tell the surgeon what to do. You just got to provide them the facilities to do an operation. And that's how I see my role always. I'll manage the hospital, and within it we have certain units, and one is definitely a very specialized one in managing the Protea. So that's been my philosophy for a very long time. And I do think it takes off. It takes away a lot of the frustrations from coaches and managers and players if you're not too involved on the day-to-day operations of the team.
You speak about Mark Boucher and Graham Smith being very much involved with the team. Of course, that they would be. And you were instrumental in giving Mark his first coaching job pretty much when he took over from Rob Walters at the Titans.
Yeah, we got a lot of flack for that. And also, I remember Rob didn't coach before that. He was a strength and conditioning coach. Mark at the time fit the profile of what we needed. We just won two trophies. We had a lot of Protea players. So we needed somebody that people will look up to, the eyes to go up. And not a lot of people can challenge from AB de Villiers to Farhan Biadien. We back in the day had an amazing squad, and we had a lot of gifted youngsters coming through, and Aiden Markram, Lungin Gidi. So he fitted that profile in terms of what people look up to him. It's not to say that there's no place for a career coach or somebody with a level 3 or level 4, but at the time at the Titans, that's not what we needed. Yeah, I think he was mad. He was coach of the year the first 2 years. He won 5 trophies in 3 seasons. Just amazing. So it worked for us. It was brave at the time, but leadership's also about bravery. Once you've decided and profiled the ideal candidate and you've got him, then you've got a balance. It worked out quite nicely for us. Rob started a very good process for us. Rob is well educated. He's a sports scientist. Been around Gary for a long time, and Barry Apton. He learned a lot, so he could influence and put processes in place for us. And he also won us 4 trophies. And at the time, he's a hard worker, but the coach that followed on him had to be a Mark Boucher. Mark Boucher is a very good coach. Let me tell you now, Sean. He's also probably received a lot of harsh criticisms, but he's hardworking. He's a legend of the game. He understands. He's tactically very strong. There's no grey areas with him. He literally runs with the team. He's somebody that embraces hard work, a hard approach, high level of accountability. It's somebody you want to coach. If your ex-players get to that level, you know, you're absolutely blessed. And like I say, I don't think there's anybody in that setup that you can challenge. You know, he's just assertive enough. And he's been around a long time. So there's a high level of credibility, which I think helps.
Did you receive a lot of flack as well? I certainly saw a lot on social media with the appointment of him to the national setup with Enoch Nkwer had been serving the role on a temporary basis. But firstly, did you get a lot of flack? And how is that setup working with Mark and Enoch working side by side?
Look, in sport, if you appoint a national coach, you get a lot of praise and flack. You can't actually scientifically try to work out that one appointment makes so many people happy and so many people angry, but that is sport for you. You know, it would range from ridiculous to brilliant and genius. So I do think the Enoch appointment before the Indian Tour in 2019 was brave of him to take it on. It's a difficult tour to do. So when we came back, you can imagine there's expectations from him to go on, and we sat down with him. He was absolutely honest with us about his expectations and also that he of course, was disappointed when he didn't get it. And the moment we got the cricketing brains in one room, they became a unit like I've seldom seen before. You also got Volga Mosabalela, which was the manager. And Enoch Nkwer is an incredible individual, and I believe that he one day will also coach South Africa. He's just started off his coaching career at one season with Lions, and he did exceptionally well. And, you know, he's a hard worker. He communicates well. They've been through a tough time. I think the Australian series that ended as it did meant a lot for them. A lot of things falls into place when you win. You've got team, you've got team spirit. People back each other. So that's what happened with him. But he's an ideal person. I've got no doubts it'll be a national coach, hopefully for South Africa one day. Fantastic individual to work with. A lot of praise for Enoch. He's a good man.
We've got the coaches and assistant coaches sorted out. The ODI captain's sorted out, but Graham Smith recently announcing that Quinton de Kock would not be captaining the test side. Are you privy as to who might be taking over the reins or who would be of those in the reckoning?
Look, Derek, man, let me not try and speculate too much, but you know, we've had some discussions. I don't think they've totally made up their mind. They got a bit of time. It's got a lot to do with workload, I would imagine, and maybe also a different tactical mindset for your longer version of the game. I guess it's a clear indication that I haven't announced somebody by now that they're still looking at a few options. There's some strong leaders in there. There's Aidan Markram, of course, Dean Elgar, Rassie, Van der Dusen is held in high regard. You might do what they did with Graham, is go with a youngster and give him a bit of a run in it. I'm sure there's a big debate around it, but they haven't made up their mind at this stage.
And just sticking with the Proteus side, sorry, we're wrapping up soon. I know it's been a very long grilling, Jacques. But CSA came out towards the end of last year, and there were a lot of surprising comments, people saying that they were very surprised by the news when CSA announced that they were in favour of the ICC's approach to four-day test matches and adopting that strategy. Of course, many people said, well, that's not test cricket. The history books say it's always got to be 5 days. And I can completely sign with that. But I did a bit of research at the time, and I know that organisations the world over are hemorrhaging money, and now we've got COVID-19 taking place, and that's just put things even to into a worse of state. And I look back at the last 5 years with South Africa hosting test matches, and I found this stat that we had hosted 26 test matches, only 9 went to a fifth day. Four days were 9 tests. We had 6 three-day tests, and then we had 1 two-day test, which is crazy, and then we had 1 that was rained out. I can imagine that the money lost on those lost days, particularly against sides who are considered minnows, and I don't like using that word, but I mean, you know that if you're going up against an England or an Australia, you're going to have a far tougher fight on your hands than if you go up at home against, say, a New Zealand, although New Zealand are certainly pushing themselves up a lot further these days. But I can imagine that the losses when tests don't go the full 5 days are staggering.
I think the modern lifestyle, and that's it's good data that you have there. The modern lifestyle, you know, there's a lot of competitions in the world that is actually done over 5 days. I think that is the one concern. You know, as cricket's always cut off overs, you know, they're looking to cut off days now as well, and it's how the world evolves. I do think you're right, and it should be opponent specific. You know, do you? If you can sell out 5 days, you can imagine the Ashes. You know, they would want 5 days. But for me, it's got to be opponent specific. I think in December, Biff said he didn't know. I said, you know, we must talk to stakeholders, and the president said 4. So you know, it's also indication that there's a bit of uncertainty about it. But you surely got to consider data like you did now. If you want to play the Ashes over 5 days, then it's fine. If England play one of the other teams and it should be 4 days or scheduled 4 days, yeah, definitely. You know, it also fills up the FTP. Unfortunately, the Red Bull format's still got a lot of support, but the big money is with the White Ball format. Especially the change in India. So India viewer content now goes for the shorter version of the game, not as much test cricket. And I think that makes a big influence on it as well. And certain of the matches just don't make sense. I'm not sure if the night test matches really worked or always worked. Didn't have the effect that people were hoping for. So in my mind, that you should give consideration to 4 day tests.
Just talk us through some of those losses that you do experience, because I think most people just automatically assume you're talking ticket sales, so you lose that. But of course, that wasn't a big part of the pie to begin with. We talk about costs involved, like security and catering, etc. And those things are things that you've had to have paid for well in advance, and you simply can't cancel a day before when you know that this match is going to end a lot quicker than 5 days.
Yeah, also accommodation. You can imagine if you can cut a day off, you know, it's big groups. The touring groups are much bigger and bigger. You could easily, you know, save on anything between 60 to 80 rooms. A tour in a 5-star hotel, that in itself is a fair amount of money. And then from your security to cleaning, catering is big. It's massive. So, you've got to hire people working in individual suites. There's a lot that goes into it. Stock. No, it's massive. You know, it's if you take a test at the at SuperSport Park, you take match day income and match day expenses. On a 5-day test match, you budget for just on match day income and match day expenses anything between 1.5 to 1.8 million rand loss. Of course, if you then quantify your income from suites and sponsorship, it tilts in a positive actually hosting matches. But then, of course, if you can cut out a fifth of your costs on a test, theoretically, that's 20% of it. So, by now, they probably would budget for a 2 million rand effort over 5 days in terms of a loss. So that's 400,000 rand. You know, it's significant. That's one test match. That's not taking into account your hotel costs, which could be quite. It can be, it's a significant amount. It's not a small saving. And hence, if the data indicates that most of it will only go 4 days anyway, you've got to take that into account.
Yeah. And, this interview has certainly been one of very much doom and gloom in terms of the past. But looking ahead to the future, you've got to just hope. And as you say, you've got plenty of plans in place to make content, to ensure that you guide the ship towards less rough waters. One massive positive must be the growth of the women's game in South Africa. And we saw how well the Proteas women did over in Australia recently at the T20 World Cup, losing agonizingly in the semi-final to the hosts Australia, who went on to win the tournament. But the biggest shining light for me throughout the tournament was the following that it garnered back home. And it really captured the imagination of the public. And that's exactly what you need in the women's game, or in any game, theoretically. But you must have been very, very pleased with, firstly, their performance, and secondly, what their performance did for the fans.
Well, we've seen a massive growth in viewership, especially in online content for the women's game. I think the stats they gave us is probably that it was the most watched women's event, and the in-stadia support was a world record as well. So a lot of positives, and our team played so well, and they're easy to support, they're easy to follow. So hopefully, yeah, you're right, that is a property that's come to the fore. If you asked me if 10 years ago if we'd name a gate in honor of Mignon Leprio, a women's Protea player, I would probably not say yes, but that's exactly what we did. We honored her at Supersport Park. She's such a wonderful person, such a great example to young girls and women. But the women's game has grown, so there is a positive. I think you can monetize it much better than we did in the past. If I may say, Momentum has come on board for a sponsor to sponsor them, and they're also excited about the growth in the game. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see. Yeah, it's tough times, Derek. I think one must make a deliberate decision to stay positive and to play a leadership role and to sit and come up with a good strategy that mitigates the effect of this. And like I say, I always see myself as a temporary custodian of the game and a privileged person to be in a capacity where I do have a bit of a hand on the steering wheel of where we're going. So that in itself is a massive honor, but also obligation. And it's one that one should not take lightly. You should try your best. The amount of research we've done of late is unreal. The benchmarking, reaching out to other codes, other countries to see what they are doing. I said in the beginning, there's a low level of predictability. There's no historic data. There's no historic case study in this. It's almost like a world war. So hopefully, cricket, like it survived the world wars of the past, will also survive this.
Well, Jacques, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you as always. I don't think you expected this to go as long as it did when I messaged you a couple of days ago. And to do it on a holiday, I really appreciate it. Although, granted, most of these days, not a holiday at all, but we certainly are cooped up in our homes back home. But I really hold thumbs and wish you all of the best for the future in these very troubled and uncertain times. And congratulations on doing what you've managed to achieve in your short stint back at the top. As like I said at the beginning of the show, in one of the hottest of hot seats in South African sport.
Always nice to have a chat with you, Derek. Always nice. Hopefully we can do it again one day.
I look forward to it. It's going to be brilliant. Cheers, Jacques. And enjoy the rest of your Freedom Day.
Thanks, Derek. Same to you.
Thanks for listening to Inside the Game, brought to you by Raider Media.